Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create a good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm pleased to be in conversation with Caroline Bainbridge. Caroline's a colleague, and we're going to do something different today. Rather than be a guest and go through an interview format, we're going to have a conversation. And the hot topic today, of course, is the war in Ukraine. It's been on both of our minds a lot. We've been very active in the public sphere, thinking about this, holding open sessions about this. So, Caroline, just introduce yourself before we dive into the Ukraine war.
Thanks for inviting me to talk to you about this, Simon. I am an organizational consultant, an analytic network coach, and an emeritus professor of psychoanalysis and culture associated with Roehampton University in London. But I'm based in Liverpool by the sea. So that's where I am today.
So you're very welcome, Caro. And I chose Caro to kind of do this weaving work with. We're going to do some weaving. We talk in our coaching course about composting and weaving, and it's a way of thinking about what's going on around us, within us, between us, all as citizens. And we're going to do some weaving together. And I really like Caro's work. She's very into culture and into psychoanalysis. So let's try and frame this around our psychosocial kind of way of thinking, Caro. I think the first thing to say is I'm still kind of really shocked by what's happening. I actually feel in a state of bodily shock, really.
It's a daily experience for me. It's I'm still trying to judge for myself at what point in the day I can actually try to embrace the news and actually consume the news or keep up with the horrors that are just being unleashed, you know, that by the hour. It's really, really difficult to manage and process the emotion. And I think that there's a huge part of this that is really very much about the experience of news, isn't it? That it's relentless. It's every day that you can literally follow live blogs on your preferred platform about what's going on minute by minute across the world. And there's something deeply difficult in terms of trying to process global information on that scale and try to figure it out without space to think. So I think we've got a space to think here together, which is great. I'm also really interested in your essay, the essay that you wrote recently on the need to take a stance. And I wonder if you can just tell me a bit more about what was in your mind and what drove you to write that essay.
Yeah, this is right at the beginning of the war. I started the conversation before the war on some of the listservs I'm with about we had to be more active and to think about this. And I was really triggered by what I felt was very much a process of disassociation, very much around the psychosocial kind of coaches, let's call it therapist culture. So in therapist culture, there's a lot of people who focus on individualism. There's the systemic thinkers. And there's quite a lot of people, quite shocked me really, by really disassociating from what was actually happening. Like, this was a ferocious and, in my view, a completely unnecessary war. I mean, we can look at the systemic reasons for it. You can say the encroachment of NATO. You can have all these different reasons. But with all those reasons, the means to kind of achieve those ends were completely unrelated. And something else was happening. And that something else was the Putin regime, you know, fighting for its own power, its desire to kind of retain its own power, reinforce that at home. And I think there was kind of some grandiose idea of building new empire and the Putin regime being the new saviors of Russia, etc. And this was being imposed on a people who'd only recently found their independence. You know, they've been under the cosh of the Soviet Empire for many years. And it was just shocking to me that people were kind of rationalizing this. Solzhenitsyn wrote in the around about the 1917 kind of revolutions, and he talked about kind of false liberals. And it stuck with me because it's like, yeah, it's like people can take up this ultra liberal position saying we can't pick sides, and anybody kind of takes a stance is taking a binary position. And I wanted to challenge that, really. So I wrote this essay and I kind of basically brought out some points, and I said, yes, the war is systemic. Everything is systemic. Apartheid was systemic. Nazi Germany was systemic. It doesn't mean that we can't condemn it. You know, so just because it's systemic, it doesn't mean we can't condemn it.
I find it staggering as well that this logic of binaries is still so dominant in a world that's so networked. I mean, you know, you can encounter, and I understand it in the context, you know, the prevalence of cancel culture, so-called cancel culture, and this idea of, you know, you either belong, you're either with us or you're against us, and therefore, you know, we will cancel one another out. And the toxicity and the kind of, you know, immaturity of that level of thinking, that's that proper paranoid schizoid mentality, isn't it? And that's fostered by, you know, all kinds of technologies and stuff. But at the same time, there's an invitation in the technologization of the world and our experience of it, the mediatization of everything that we experience. You know, you can find mediated versions of everything these days, to actually try to put yourself in the place of the other, to try to understand what the experience of the other is, whilst also at the same time actually holding a kind of space in between for thinking and for dialogue. And I think that that's what you touch on so neatly in that essay. It's posted on Medium, I think, isn't it, if people want to get hold of it. But I think what you touch on really neatly there is that there is this falseness around the claims to neutrality that is not actually doing anything other than, in my mind at least, warding off an invitation to act. It's kind of a medical model of watch and wait, watchful waiting. You know, let's see what happens. Let's see where we go. And in the meantime, every day, thousands and thousands of people are having violent wrought upon their persons and their properties and their cultures and their environments. And it's unthinkable. It's completely unthinkable. And I think the unthinkableness is also something that we need to talk about, actually.
Yeah, I think it's partly kind of a disassociation and blanking out thinking, and you know, and often the people kind of saying we can't take a stance, we can't, you know, we can't make a choice because we mustn't pick sides. I'm like, what, you know, and like making the point that not taking a stance is actually taking a stance. There's no such thing as not taking a stance. You know, every position you take, even if you claim neutrality, is taking a stance, you know, and it has an impact. And just making the links as well, I found that through taking a stance, it doesn't inhibit a systemic view. It doesn't inhibit understanding some of the causes. And it should actually help us think about, you know, how we can provide thinking spaces, how we can support victims of violence, how we can support refugees, and how we can actually think about ending this kind of war. I mean, the first thing we want to do is end this kind of immediately. It's not kind of this is just a dreadful, dreadful situation. And the, you know, but to be able to think about it in a way where absolutely the Putin regime is acting in its own interest. The Putin regime is acting in the most violent and despicable way, and that needs calling out, you know, that, you know, and we have to learn that lesson. We didn't, I mean, the other thing triggered me, I've worked in Russia four times. I've spent time in Belarus. I have family in Poland, just, you know, we're not far from the border. And just the reality of kind of knowing what Belarus is like, you know, and Putin would like to turn Ukraine into Belarus, you know, a totalitarian dictatorship. That's what it is. You know, it really is, you know, and it's like, and he's turning his own Russia into that, you know. And I visited Russia, and you're always aware that was some things you could say and some things you couldn't say. You know, I teach leadership, and that is interesting in the class. Some people said, yeah, you can talk about anything, you know, this is a free country. And yet nobody talked about Putin, you know, and I kind of knew not to talk about Putin. But out of the clampdown now in Russia, I feel very sorry for the Russian. You know, I have a great affinity to kind of Russia when I was there, and to the Russian citizens there. I fear not just for what's happening in Ukraine, but for the long-term region, really, what's going to happen in terms of kind of back to kind of Soviet kind of humiliations on a daily basis.
We're seeing that kind of in condensed images all the time, aren't we? So I'm thinking about the journalist who made her very brave protest the other day, Marina Ovsinikova, and the way in which she stands as a kind of avatar and emblem, if you like, of the repressive totalitarian state and the impact on the lived experience of our Russian neighbours and our Russian friends, you know, because I think there's an important distinction to draw as well, isn't there, between condemnation of Putin and his regime versus condemnation of Russia as a people. And that experience, I suppose, you know, if I try to kind of think constructively about the supposed neutrality of systemic thinking, then maybe it's an effort to kind of remain in contact with the experience of the repressive state and the fear that must be alive for the people in Russia. But there is, I agree with you that there's nothing to prohibit us from taking a stance and uttering condemnation, opening our arms and our hearts and doing what we can to move towards some kind of resolution, aid, support, creation of thinking spaces and creation of an opportunity to hold on to something of humanity in all of this, whilst at the same time being able to be in contact with the horrors being experienced by the people in the regime. And I think there's all kinds of stuff in the psychoanalytic literature, isn't there, around, you know, the psychic retreat, for instance. You know, what is it that we can't see when we decide not to act or not to take a position? How are we occupying or closing down aspects of our mind and aspects of our experience? But it's also, I was thinking, you know, about Freud's writing on war and how he very much framed it in terms of the evolution of civilization. And for me, the systemic approach is very much about how are we learning from this experience, that it's not fixed, that there's not a kind of expectation that you just don't take a position because that's a binary, you're opting into a binary mentality. It's how our thinking and how our processes are revolving and responding to the experience that we're seeing in front of our eyes and thinking about that whilst acting, because it's not enough just to think, is it?
No, I mean, I did some thinking about this around COVID, around Lacan's idea of the three moments. He has an idea of logical time, and he talks about the moment of the glance, a time for understanding, and a time for comprehending. And the final stage is the time when you have to take a leap of faith and act and take a stance. And I actually think that many people struggle to do the first two parts, you know, the moment of seeing is like, you know, have we really seen, you know, we didn't see when we crushed those people in Belarus, when the Putin regime crushed those people in Belarus and the West just turned their back and forgot them. I was horrified. I keep talking about it, probably because I've been into Minsk and I kind of, you know, their faces, you know, they're human faces for me rather than kind of just something over there. And just knowing that, you know, probably some of the people that was there with were the kind of people who would be on the demonstrations and now be languishing in some jail, being tortured, you know. And we just turned our back, you know. We as a West, we kind of cheered on the demonstrators, and then, like, you know, just turned our back. And it's like, you know, that you know, we didn't see what was happening. You know, in Crimea, we didn't see what was happening. We kind of put a few sanctions and then turned our back, you know, and carried on trading, carried on letting it happen. And now I think there is a moment of seeing now, you know, and the second phase of a moment of understanding, you know. And when you take the third stance of kind of stepping into the unknown, you never have 100% certainty. You know, it's always an act of faith, working with the best knowledge you have and making a judgment. And it doesn't stop you continue to think. This is a circular kind of thing. This is not kind of just a one moment. But I really think that there is a moment in history we're looking at, which is not just about this current crisis, which is absolutely dreadful, but actually about the next decades and decades of how humanity in that region thrives or is repressed.
And I think here there's a really important lesson. I find, as you know, I find the work of Christopher Bolas really illuminating in this context in particular, and in lots of others actually. But he talks in the work that he's written recently about bewilderment and the age of bewilderment, about the lessons of history being the most profound losses. You know, what we've lost is the lessons of history and a capacity to learn from history. And I wonder really about how that's tied to technology and mediatization and the way in which we were able to kind of hold everything at a distance because it's witnessed through a screen. You know, it's witnessed through relentless kind of scrolling of images, relentless experience of accounts on social media. Of, I saw yesterday David Beckham had handed over his Instagram account to a doctor in Kharkiv, and the way in which the mediated environment offers this incredibly powerful proximity to experience whilst also allowing us to hold it off at a distance. And there is something about screens and all of this, and, you know, in thinking about what's being screened and what's being screened in our imagination, in our unconscious, and what's being witnessed, or how we can tally what we're witnessing in terms of factual experience on a screen, that in a way that that kind of sits in, you know, the apocalyptic kind of imagery of cinema and fiction and so on. And I'm also struck, you know, what you're talking about looking people in the face. Zelensky himself has kind of mobilized this mentality, hasn't he? He made that extraordinary speech. I think it goes on for about 9 to 10 minutes in Russian, right at the start of the war, in which he tried to correct some of the mistruths being perpetrated by and perpetuated by Putin around the Ukrainians and the experience of Ukrainian people being oppressed and under the control of a Nazi regime. And I think Zelensky talks about, you know, what we will take up arms to defend ourselves, but we are not at war. We are not perpetrating war. We're not perpetrating attack. Where would I perpetrate attack? In Donetsk, where I've looked people in the face, in, you know, and he names all of these different places and talks about his lived personal experience. And I'm very, very interested in Zelensky as a character who seems to have been able to shrug off the shackles of being perceived as a politician. There is something about him that is in contact with humanity and what it is to be a human being that he mobilizes very well in his political speeches and in his encounters with other politicians and with governments around the world. And there's something about our system and our culture, I think, where, you know, somebody who has been an actor, somebody who has been a comedian, speaks more sense or seems to speak more truth and is therefore able to be a mouthpiece of the humanitarian kind of dimension of this experience in a way that fosters trust and fosters identification. And I'm interested to think about that a bit more. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I've written something on LinkedIn yesterday about this. So I kind of, as you know, my view on eco-leadership is very much about distributing leadership and trying to question the idea of charismatic and transformational heroic leadership. And I see, you know, that I think Forbes magazine wrote Zelensky, the ideal transformational leader, lessons we can learn and sort of try and translate into business speak, which is a bit
distasteful. Yeah.
But I mean, what I like to try and do is say, absolutely, I totally agree with what you said. He has mobilized that, but also to try and understand what's been mobilized in him, that I think that he's been mobilized by the great leadership of Ukrainian people. I had a colleague in Ukraine who wrote to me, and we shared it on Clubhouse, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And she wrote about the that mobilization, about the amazing self-organization which is taking place, you know, this kind of self-managing leadership, this eco-leadership where people were taking up roles, they were helping each other, they were being innovative, they were being hugely courageous, you know. So there's this whole mobilization of leadership, which I think is not just about Zelensky's kind of a personality. I think it is that as well, and his media savvy skills, but also that he's actually channeling this kind of in some ways he's taking up followership. He's kind of being mobilized by this grassroots leadership and speaking to the world with that voice, I think. And I think that's a very interesting part of it as well. It's not just some person taking it on themselves. He's actually part of this collective leadership effort, which is immense and amazing, and just kind of blowing us all away by how kind of courageous it is.
Yeah, and I think part of the significance of it is the way in which it's showcasing humanity and the way in which, in the face of this absolutely horrific lived experience, you know, being shelled, being bombed, finding, you know, all kinds of buildings, maternity hospitals, brand new shopping centres, you know, being collapsed in minutes, and the devastating effects of that for the future as well as for right now, the Ukrainians are showing an incredible humanity, and that our network culture allows us to kind of be in contact with that. So that's where the hope resides. I was reading a piece yesterday about a music bar in Kyiv called the Buena Vista Music Bar. And the owner hasn't yet closed the bar. It's still open, but it's become a space in which journalists, in which those lawyers, accountants, shopkeepers who have volunteered and are taking up arms and basically becoming the patrols on the street protecting Kyiv, can come together. And one of the things that the bar owner speaks about is the need for spaces to come together in order to not have to read the news alone, to not have to read the devastating numbers of lives lost, of injuries perpetrated, of children, of refugees escaping the country and so on, but for there to be a shared point of contact with the experience. And I was really, it was one of the most moving things I've read this week, to kind of watch, it was a little video reportage actually, of an interview with the bar owner. And, you know, he is still trying to offer a menu in the midst of, you know, and choice, like several dishes and stuff. And there's something about what it means to be human. And it really reminded me of Freud's writing on war, because he very much speaks about, you know, he uses the term civilization, but he sees civilization as something that is evolving in response to experience, and that what is being lost in the midst of war is humanity. It's the result of, you know, years and years of the evolution of culture, of the evolution of creativity, and getting all of that is being eradicated, you know, with the dropping of bombs and what have you. But there's something inside us that we can hold on to in relation to that creative thinking. And I think that's what you're touching on, really, in the way that you're writing about all of this.
Yeah, and I think this is really important to kind of hold on to, this deep kind of experience of humanity, which I think we've lost, not lost, but I think we've repressed in ourselves in the West. I think you know, when these wars happen, we can quickly jump in, and we get the right-wing media, which has been kind of and right-wing politicians, which have been denigrating immigrants for ages and stopping a humane kind of response to immigrants in Syrian immigrants in UK, in America, etc. We've seen these kind of and now a huge swing towards kind of an awakening to humanity because of it's a European war. And so there's questions there, but I think it's awakening a lot of people who were really repressing the idea of the deep humanity, the deep desire for the freedom for expression, the deep desire for the freedom to think and to be human in collaboration with others. And I think we've not served ourselves well. I think neoliberal capitalism has kind of like created quite inhumane workspaces for people. And I think that there's this kind of been this, rather than just point at the kind of Putin regime or them over there for authoritarianism, as you know, kind of I've been writing about authoritarianism for the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and you've been talking about it. And you know, in our progressive circles, we've kind of repressed people's voices. You know, there's the populist nationalist movements, which are the same old tropes. And I think it's the same tropes which, you know, if you mirror like Trump and Putin, you get Make America Great Again, you get Make Russia Great Again. You know, it's, you know, you get Putin doing the rallies, you get Trump doing the rallies, you get the same tropes. You know, we're the victims. If we can only get rid of the bad other, the West or the immigrants or whichever the bad other is, and it's exactly the same tropes being used. You know.
Yeah, and I think that's where the binaristic logic is, isn't it? It's in that kind of very polarized space of good versus bad. You know, fascism versus progressive liberalism, taken to the hard left and so on. And that's where the toxicity lies for me. But I think there's something interesting going on about subjecthood versus objecthood, which is what Bolas suggests is going on for us at the moment, that what we're doing in a networked age is really kind of fracturing our sense of self, so that there is the self that is an embodied self, you know, that lives in a house, an apartment with one's family, you know, might take oneself off to an office or a shop to do the daily grind, or even, you know, be living on the poverty line and not being able to access food and heat and, you know, worried about the extraordinary impact of this war on the whole of the world in terms of the global impacts and on the global economy and so on. And then there are versions of the self that are split off, that are in online, that are, you know, doing the representative thing of, you know, this kind of distance kind of representation of, these are my thoughts, this is my experience, this is my emotion. It's a kind of call to action. It's a kind of evacuation of experience into a space that is removed from this terrible, difficult kind of lived environment in which we live. And Bolas talks about this in terms of, you know, objecthood, and that subjecthood has basically gone out of the window, and that we occupy the world in a state of objecthood, that things are done to us and things are transmitted from one person to the other, and that this is our role in a networked kind of environment. And there's a cri de cœur there, isn't there, about where's the subjecthood right now? And what does subjecthood look like in a highly mediated, highly networked scenario of war that is not necessarily a war that is restricted in its geopolitical terrain, that we know that there is a very real threat of proliferation in terms of whether that's nuclear proliferation or whether it's proliferation into a war that kind of goes beyond the boundaries of Ukraine, Belarus, Chechen, and so on, and spills over into Third World War, and what that puts us in touch with in terms of the lessons from history that we've lost.
Yeah, that's very important. I think there's a few things I'd like to pick up there. One is that, you know, populist, nationalist ways of thinking always try and create a mass identity. They always try and create the people against, and within, once you get a mass identity, you lose your subjectivity, you lose your humanity, you become kind of just part of a massive blob. And, you know, I think analytic work is all about kind of really finding uniqueness, our unique jouissance, our unique symptoms within a collective. Mm-hmm. Now, Lacan talks about in the final summary, it's all about the social bond. Mm-hmm. You know? And yet we have to kind of think about kind of our uniqueness, our jouissance, the way we kind of find our deepest humanity. Mm-hmm. and live it, you know, within that social bond, you know. So you'll hear me say a lot, you know, put your symptom to work, not just for yourself, but for society.
And, you know, it's there in Freud's letter to Einstein as well, isn't it? He talks about the dimension of humanity being the emotional bond, that unless you can sustain that emotional bond, you either fall into right or might, as the kind of slightly dodgy translation has it. But yeah, I think that I kind of keep asking myself, and I said this to you the other day, I keep coming back to that Black Eyed Peas song of "Where is the love at the moment?" In response to almost anything and everything that's happening, it's that question of where is the love? And I'm struggling to kind of think about where hope resides in a situation of this magnitude. And for me, I think there's a kind of lesson from what happened around the globe in response to the early stages of lockdown and COVID-19. And it happened certainly across Europe. That there was a turn to micro communities and a kind of return to being in touch with the people on your street in a way that, you know, perhaps you might not have been in your everyday life beforehand, and a turn to the idea of mutual aid. You know, in the UK, there was a lot of establishment of local WhatsApp groups or local mutual aid groups who would watch out for the neighbor, you know, kind of look out for the person who was shielding and needed food to be collected and dropped off, you know, with no contact and things like that. And there is some work that has been done around the kind of quiet revolution that is taking place in these kind of tiny grassroots networks of shared experience and determination. And we can see that with, you know, the way that the refugee charities have grown up and that the work that's being done locally at the moment to raise funds and to get aid, you know, physical kind of objects, bedding, clothing, food, and so on to Ukrainians who have been displaced, and the extraordinary will of people to provide for somebody at such a distance in this kind of almost overwhelming kind of plenitudinous way is quite kind of extraordinary to kind of think about. But I think that there's hope there in the local networks, and I'm using local in a kind of you know, not necessarily just a geographical kind of sense, but it's in the points of local contact, the shared values that we have with one another, in the way in which networks can help us to be in touch with that, are the spaces of hope, I think.
I think that's right. I think there's many, many examples. I mean, there's a criticism of which interests me around racism, around are we just responding to this war because it's a European war, because it's white-skinned people. And I want to kind of talk about that openly. I think it's difficult to talk about, and I frame it around the idea of proximity. I've been thinking a lot about proximity and identification, and I wholly agree that there's racism. There's racism in Europe. There's particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, where there's not been a big, large experience of multiculturalism. You know, there's some nationalist politics as well around, sort of against LGBT communities. So yes, it's there. There's also, I read something the other day on people saying, do we only care about kind of white wars? And I'm thinking, well, actually, the biggest demonstration I remember in the history was against the Iraq war. You know, over a million people turned out against the Iraq war, you know, and I was thinking about the amazing job Angela Merkel did with Syrians, taking in 900,000, nearly a million Syrians. So, you know, it's not just this kind of polarized position. Yes, there has been racism. We've seen African students being turned back. We've seen Syrians not being welcomed in the way that Ukrainians are. So absolutely, yes, we need to look at that. But also to kind of be realistic around kind of how we do identify more with close neighbors. You know, so this war, I think, triggered us in many ways. It triggered me in a way, like, firstly, I have family in Poland, and thinking about nuclear fallout, an expansive nuclear war. Like, this is a return of the repressed as well. We kind of borrowed some of the memories of the totalitarian kind of Soviet Union. You know, we're free from that now. We're above that now. Well, we're not, you know. The Second World War was absolutely devastating. You know, people talk about war, but 50 million died, you know, in Poland, 6 million in Ukraine. Stalin kind of killed 3.5 million just in one kind of starvation period. You know, the whole kind of Stalinization, the experience, this is very close to people, both in terms of geographic closeness and in terms of historical closeness. You know, I have family, extended family in Poland who grew up in communism, you know, a grandmother who grew up in fascism and saw the Nazis in Poland and then the Stalinists and then the communist regime, you know, and this is in our lived history. It's alive today, very much alive today, you know, and yet we repressed it. And this is a return of the repressed.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think there's also something very interesting about proximity in that. And I mentioned screens earlier on, but I do think that the role of the screen is quite interesting here, because it's about how you are, you know, we know how screens operate. We identify, there is a kind of deep identification with what we see on screen, and we will have a greater experience of identification with what we see on screen according to our own experience. And according to our own inscription and location in social and cultural and historical, geographical and geopolitical contexts, there's something about proximity that puts us immediately in touch with narcissism, doesn't it? And the idea of the narcissistic drive that Freud spoke about being kind of integral to, you know, the development of maturity and so on. But there is something about narcissism that also enables a recognition of something that is so horrific and unspeakable that puts us in touch with the horrific and unspeakable dimensions of our own narcissistic tendencies, our own racist tendencies, the ways in which we're being encouraged more broadly in society to reflect and talk openly about the as white people of our role and our part, the part that we have played wittingly or unwittingly in racist regimes and racist processes and so on. And I think that there is something in proximity psychologically that puts us in touch with the unthinkable, the unspeakable, and causes it to come up in us. And perhaps there is something to think about there in terms of the flight to empathy. And that's not to, you know, that's by no means intended as a criticism of the huge donations and the huge rush to house Ukrainian refugees and so on and so forth. But there is something about a flight to empathy that I think is telling us something about the pain of what we're witnessing. And I think you're absolutely right. It's the pain of this close historical experience, this close personal geopolitical experience. But it's also, I think, something that it's the deeply, deeply dark dimension of subjecthood that is also repressed that comes up in us, and we have to own our part in it.
Yeah, and it's, I'm interested when you talk about identifying through screens, because you used the phrase before, being screened off, and I think two things happen. I mean, screens can enable you to identify, but they can also enable you to disassociate.
Absolutely.
Because it's just a screen, isn't it? It's just a, you know, so how do you differentiate, like you were saying before, between kind of an absolutely devastating kind of human experience and the film you just come back from the cinema with, or kind of, you know.
Well, it's a paradoxical experience, isn't it? It's a deeply contradictory experience, because you're both identifying, but there is a distance, you know, there is a distance between actually our eyes and the screens that we're looking at. You know, that distance is receding in terms of the phones are ever closer to our faces and our bodies, but there is a distance that allows us to hold things off and ward things off. And I'm interested in the psychological mechanism of that, of how you can both be in the position of identifying, but that there is I think there's about a call for containment as well, about where is the containment and where is the holding for this complex experience, in the way that in a situation where events are going at such pace, experience is so fraught on so many dimensions in so many situations, that where is the space for containment? Where is the space for holding? And I think that part of, you know, the phenomenon of so-called doom scrolling, you know, where you constantly can't put your phone down and so on and so forth, it's a pursuit, it's a hunger for space to be contained.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that we can provide some spaces for containment. We've tried on Clubhouse. We did a webinar recently with 100 people thinking about what was going on. Mm-hmm. We're doing this podcast. I'd like to return to this. We'll do some more weaving together in a short while, Caro, and maybe take a focus on looking at ourselves. And I mean, one thing that's really interested me around kind of this rise of authoritarianism, and we see it in China, we see it in Russia, we see it in our own mm-hmm. Country, you know, through the kind of UK and Brexit, mm-hmm. through Trump in the States, and through Eastern Europe and Central Europe. I just asked a question. I mean, I'm interested in libidinal kind of experience and libidinal economy, you know, how emotions really drive kind of a behavior, and how they get used by politicians, how you know, fears, anxieties, and depressions get kind of mobilized by politicians. And I think we need to kind of not just allow this war to be turned into kind of the bad other and the good us, because we've got lots of things to dig deep and think about in the good us, and think about our own attachments to kind of violence, our own attachments to aggression, our own attachments to not seeing the kind of the troubled self within ourselves, really, and particularly kind of I'd like to think about something which I think has been repressed, and that is the desire for democracy, for liberal thinking, for some thinking. And I'm certainly not thinking about this in terms of free market capitalism.
Exactly, yeah.
I think we can attach that. So let's come back together and discuss that as part of this ongoing way of trying to understand what's happening.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd really welcome that. You know, it seems deeply appropriate the day after I'm reading about Boris Johnson's apparent desperation to get to Ukraine. And my cynicism is he's desperate to get to Ukraine to kind of save his premiership, basically. It's not about desperation to be there by any stretch of the imagination. It's about a very kind of personal, selfish kind of drive and a fight for survival. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely on point, and that's the question of the day for me.
Good. Well, we'll leave it there. So thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. We'll come back and we'll do some more composting and weaving together. Thank you all for listening, everybody, and we won't see you, but we'll create a space for thinking in the near future. We might return to Clubhouse where you can have your say as well. So thanks very much, Carol. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.